Last Sunday, we kicked off our Advent Christmas series. We've called it Responding to Christmas, and we're walking through the Christmas story in the New Testament, looking at different stories of characters and individuals and learning about how they responded to God and how you and I maybe can and are and should respond to the story of Jesus Christ as well. Last week, Kevin kicked this off, not wearing that suit, but wearing a normal outfit there. He kicked it off through this probably one of the lesser-known characters in the Christmas story, a character named Anna. In fact, I had a few people say, I don't think I'd ever even heard of that character in the scripture before. So it was a great hope. If you were not here, I'd encourage you to go back and listen or watch online or on our app. You can listen to last week's and watch last week's message. But today, I'm excited about today because we're going to look at a character in the Christmas story that is definitely more well-known than Anna was in the Christmas story. But it's also a person that I'm willing to bet we don't give a lot of time and attention to. We know the name, we know who the person is, we may have heard something or a couple of things about who they are and how they played out in the story. But some of you might just think of this person as a footnote to the story of the birth of Christ, or maybe you look at it as kind of a side story to the story of the birth of Christ, but certainly not a central figure in most of our minds to Christ's birth. But I want to suggest that this person is extremely important in the Christmas narrative because I think it might just be the person with whom we can most closely identify to their response to God. Maybe say it a little differently. I think this person and the way they responded to Jesus, you and I are most likely at some point in our life to respond the exact same way to the message and the story of Christ, and certainly even as Christians to respond the way this person did to what God is doing and wants to do in our life. And when we get into this person's story, you're probably, as we walk through this, going to think to yourself, how in the world am I anything like this individual? So anyway, that's, and hopefully at the end of it, we'll get done to the end of the message and it will actually make sense. That's my goal today, just to have a message that makes sense. That's a good goal on a Sunday, right? It is. Yeah, and because my brain is still a little fried from all the crazy football I watched yesterday. So anyway, anyway, let's jump in. All right, so at the time of the birth of Christ, at the time of Christ's birth, Jerusalem and all of Israel was being ruled by the Roman Empire. You probably know this, right? And so at the time of Christ's birth, Rome was in charge and they occupied the nation of Israel. They occupied Jerusalem and Rome was ruled by an emperor. And the emperor of Rome at the time of the birth of Christ was a guy named Caesar Augustus. Now, Caesar Augustus had a pretty significant empire. In fact, if you were to map it out, the Roman Empire at the time of the birth of Christ went from England through Italy, through that part of Europe into Mesopotamia, which is modern day Iraq, all the way almost to the border of India. All right, so from England to India was the Roman Empire, and then north and south from there as well. And so here's the question. How do you, in 2,000 years ago, if you're Caesar Augustus, how do you rule an empire when it takes you 9 months just to get from one end of it to the other, all right? I mean, today you hop on a plane, you're there in 4 hours. Not that big of a deal, right? But then it literally would take 9 months for him to travel from England to India if he wanted to visit every part of his kingdom and simply just go through it, not to mention actually having conversation and dialogue and managing and leading and ruling his empire. So how do you do that? If you're Caesar Augustus? Well, the answer was actually pretty simple. You appoint kings over small territories to rule that territory according to your will. And the king that was placed to rule over Jerusalem and Israel during the time of Caesar Augustus was a guy named Herod. Now, Herod was an interesting character in the story of the birth of Christ. Herod was half Jewish and half Edomite, which simply means he was half a descendant of Esau. All right, so Jacob and Esau and that whole story, right? So he's half Edomite, half Jewish. We know a lot of things about Herod. A couple that are really, really important for you to understand as we get a kind of a picture in our mind for who this guy is. The first thing you need to know about Herod is that he was a master builder, a tremendously master builder. In fact, he's known throughout history as Herod the Great because he built an enormous amount of great architectural structures that some are still hanging around today. For example, one of them that he did, he actually built an entire city. I've got a rendering of the city of Caesarea I want to show you. Again, it's not a picture, it's a rendering because, you know, this is 2,000 years ago. But the city of Caesarea, when Herod decided he wanted to build it, was really an insignificant little town. And Herod steps in and he decides he wants to build a city, a massive city, a trade city that he would actually dedicate to the honor of Caesar Augustus, thus the name Caesarea. And in this city, Caesarea, he built a temple of Augustus, right there kind of in the middle. He built something called the Hippodrome, which is kind of a sports arena where they would have lots of games and competitions in the Hippodrome. It would become significant later on towards the end of his life as well. We'll get there in a few minutes. He also built a port, one of the most significant, impressive ports for shipping in the region, in all of the ancient world, actually. It was more than 40 acres. It held up to 300 ships at a time, and they actually used a type of concrete that would harden underwater. Now, think about that 2,000 years ago. Basically, develop a type of concrete that we can build walls in the water, and the concrete's going to harden under the water. This was Herod. He's a pretty significant dude. He also, one of his most famous undertakings as far as building was concerned was in Jerusalem, and that was the expansion he did of the temple. Now, I've got a picture of what the temple in Jerusalem looks like today. This is, you see the exterior walls are still standing. This is from Herod's temple. In the middle, of course, now is the Dome of the Rock, which is a Muslim sacred place now, sitting actually almost exactly over what was the Holy of Holies of the temple at that time. But this is the temple wall in the area as it exists today. This is what it looked like in Herod's day. If we get the next slide. In Herod's day, in the center of it, right where the Dome of the Rock is now, was the actual Holy of Holies and a holy place. At its tallest point, it was 15 stories tall. It took 18,000 slaves to build it, many, many years. The cornerstones of this temple, some of them are estimated to weigh more than 500 tons. Now think about moving a block, a cornerstone that weighs 500 tons. You realize that's 1,000,000 pounds, all right? He's a genius master builder, was Herod. One other very significant undertaking that he took in the area of Jerusalem was actually something called Masada. This is the plain of Masada. It sits almost 2,000 feet above sea level, overlooking the Dead Sea, and he turned it into a fortress, really in case he was under siege and they could retreat to Masada. There was about a three-tier palace on top. One part of this palace literally hung over the edge of Masada, almost like it was defying gravity. You'll see on the next slide, there's still some of the ruins that are there today you can visit. It had swimming pools. It had hot water and cold water. It had enough food to outlast more than a year-long siege of everyone that was in the palace. It had cisterns that held millions of gallons of water. It was an architectural genius of a build. That is Masada. Again, it's still there today. So this is Herod, Herod the Great. And where does he get the money for all of the buildings that he undertook? Taxes. It's estimated by most historians that during the time of Jesus, the average Jew, in addition to what they paid Rome and the additional taxes that Herod levied on them for all of his building projects, that the average Jew was paying somewhere between 80 and 90% of their income in taxes. All of a sudden, you like the IRS a little bit more. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But it's not quite that bad, right? Can you believe that? The 80 or 90%. And if you could not afford to pay your taxes, what happened? They didn't negotiate. Herod would simply take your land and make you a slave to build the projects that you were supposed to be financing for him. This was Herod. And as cruel as he was unarguably one of the greatest builders of the ancient world. But the second thing you need to know about him is this. Not only was he a great builder, he was also absolutely paranoid and completely insane. Without question, all right? Once Herod was taking a trip to Rome, and he told one of his officials that he believed his wife was conspiring to kill him. So if he did not return from Rome alive, they were to have her killed. Well, he returned from Rome just fine, no attempt on his life, had his wife killed anyway, right? Just to kind of make sure that wasn't a future possibility. Another time, he believed two of his sons were conspiring not only to take his throne, but also plotting his assassination. He had no proof, just simply a gut feeling that he had. He interrogates them. They deny it. One historical document records them pleading for their life. He has them killed. Towards the end of his life, he became very, very sick. Some historians believe, based on the writings of people like Josephus and others, that he had a severe sexually transmitted disease. In addition to that, they know he had gangrene. He suffered from convulsions. He was very sick at the end of his life. And before he died, knowing that he was hated not only by the people that he ruled, but also even by his own family. He knew that no one would mourn the day of his death. So he came up with an ingenious plan. He had many of the most popular and influential Jewish leaders of the day rounded up and barricaded in the Hippodrome, that sports arena that he had built in Caesarea. And he had them locked in there in order that on the day of his death, they were to be executed so that there would be guaranteed to be mourning on the day that he died. And he was quoted as saying this, "If they will not mourn for me, they will mourn." That's Herod. Great guy, isn't he? Now, probably though, the most ruthless of his actions is actually recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. So if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn there with me. Matthew chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible, should be one underneath a seat nearby. You'll find the page number on the screen for those. Matthew chapter 2. And in Matthew chapter 2, we're introduced to Herod in terms of his role in the story of the birth of Christ. And his role in the story of birth of Christ kind of comes to pass at the same time we meet a few other individuals. We believe there's three of them. It doesn't say there's three of them. There's three gifts, right? The wise men. We'll get to them more next week. But here's what it says. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. Here's what it says. "Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we've come to worship him.' And when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And he assembled the chief priests and the scribes of the people, and he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for it's written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers, for you, from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people. So Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star would appear, and then sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.'" So it sounds like a very noble thing that he's doing, right? Hey, send the wise men, you guys go find this child, this king that's been born king of the Jews. Tell me where he is. I want to go and worship him. We actually know from later on in the story that that is not at all why he sent the wise men to find Jesus and come back and report to him. Later on in verse 13 and 14, an angel speaks to Joseph, Jesus' father, and says, "Hey, get up and take the child and flee to Egypt, because Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him." So this is, again, it's Herod. Now, that wise men, once they find the Christ child, are actually themselves warned by an angel not to return to Herod, and they leave by a different route. They do not go back and tell him where Jesus is. And look at what happens in verse 16. "Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he became furious, and he killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that had been ascertained from the wise men. And this fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet Jeremiah, 'A voice heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more.'" So this is Herod. He's a master, insatiable builder. He is a ruthless ruler of his people. And he is an absolute paranoid schizophrenic that killed the ones he loved and tortured the ones he feared. And this is the guy that I was speaking about earlier when I said, I'm looking forward to today's character because it might be the one that you and I are most alike in terms of how we tend to respond to God. And hopefully you're sitting there thinking, just exactly how am I like Herod? I'm so glad I came to the church of South Lake today. I just got called a murdering thief, right? I mean, it's a little bit offensive to think that, right? Last time I checked, I haven't killed anybody, I haven't tortured anybody, haven't stolen or taken anything from anybody. How are we like Herod? Well, when you read through the account of Herod, there's a number of action words that you hear as you read through chapter 2 of Matthew that kind of help paint a picture of who this Herod is and how he's responding internally to the story of Jesus. Just think about some of the ones we've already heard. Chapter 2, verse 2, it says, Herod heard that the king of the Jews had been born. And when he heard the king of the Jews had been born, something that he did not want to hear, we learn that he was troubled. His response was that he became troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him, it says. And so he was troubled, and then he inquired of the wise men when and where he was born. He summoned them. He sent them out to find Jesus. And while they were searching for Jesus, he himself was planning to search for and destroy the child. He became furious when they did not return to him. And then he kills all the male children, 2 years old and under. And in response to all of these responses that he had from being furious and killing and searching to destroy, what was the end result of the people around him? Everything that was good, what happened? There was weeping, there was lamenting. There were people that refused even to be comforted. So follow me here for just a minute. Herod heard something he did not want to hear. Anybody ever found yourself there? Hearing something you didn't want to hear? Let me ask it this way. Ever felt like you heard something from God you didn't want to hear? Ever been reading through the Bible and it tell you something you didn't want to hear? Ever learned something about yourself you didn't want to hear? Herod heard something he did not want to hear. And what he heard was that he might lose his spot as king. And so what happened? It troubled him. It troubled him so much that he inquired, he summoned, and he sent the wise men to bring him news of where Jesus was for the purpose of searching out Jesus to destroy him. And when that didn't work, he became so furious, he just decided to kill all the children to be sure and get the one that he wanted. And even that didn't quite work out the way he planned. Now, here's why I think you and I are most likely to, at some point in our life, if not multiple times in our life, respond to God the exact same way that Herod responded to God. Here's why. You know what was driving Herod's reaction and response? One word: control. Herod was absolutely obsessed with being in control. Being in control not only of his own life, not only being in control of the people that he ruled and the people that he led and the people that were in his family, but even, as we read through the story, was obsessed with being in control of God. He was obsessed with being in control. And here's what you need to know about this idea, because you and I have the same tendency. You know that it's true. It's been the struggle of man from the beginning. This is the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. This is why they eat of the tree that they were not supposed to eat of. It was all about control, about God holding back something from them that they believed and had been deceived into believing that they deserved. It's always about control. And you and I wrestle with the same thing, whether it's controlling the people around us or controlling the circumstances that are part of our life or controlling what's going to happen tomorrow or controlling the picture of what happened yesterday, whatever it might be. We, all of us, struggle with this need and this feeling and this desire to be in control of our lives. And sometimes that means we're even going to try and control the lives of the people around us and maybe even try and control God. And the reason it's so dangerous is because of this. Behind every sin in your life and mine, ultimately, is the attempt to control. If you were to step back and look in the mirror and begin evaluating every sin that you've ever committed that you could think of, you know, I really believe as you begin to narrow it down and pull back and look at it, you know what you would find at some point? You would find at some point, some way, some fashion, an effort on your part to control. To control somebody, to control God, to control the world around you. And the fact is, when life begins to kind of spin out of our control, much like we saw back in our study just a few weeks back through 1 Peter, when life begins to spin out of our control, where do we usually find ourselves? We find ourselves in pain. And when we're in pain, what do we most want? We want to be out of pain. And how do we react when we're in pain, trying to get out of pain? Irrationally, selfishly, arrogantly, self-righteously. There's a whole lot of adjectives you could use about that. But the bottom line is, every time you sin at some point, I'm willing to bet if you were to kind of pull through all the smoke and really narrow it down, at some point there's a desire and an attempt on your half, on your part, to control. And here's what you'll find about your attempt to control. The more you attempt to gain control, you know what will actually happen? You'll actually find yourself losing control. Your attempt to gain control will actually cause you to lose control. Now, here's why I say that. There's a story that Jesus told about 30 years after this happens with Herod. Jesus is during his time of ministry, and he's teaching, and he's walking throughout Judea and Galilee and all of that region. And he tells a story one day, one of his most famous stories that he ever told. It's the story of the prodigal son. It's found in Luke chapter 15. We're not going to turn there. We're not going to read it. Most of you probably know the story. And even if maybe you're here and you're not very familiar with the Bible and Bible stories, or maybe you've not been to church very much, I'm sure you've at least heard the term the prodigal, right? The prodigal son. So we're not going to turn there because it's a well-known story. But here's basically the gist of the story Jesus tells. It's one of his most famous stories. He says there's this wealthy guy that has two sons. And the younger son goes to the father and he says, "Father, I want you to divide my portion of the inheritance with me now." And here's why this is so significant in Jesus' day. Culturally speaking, at the time of Jesus, if a man had more than one son, the eldest son at the death of the father would receive a double portion of the father's inheritance. What that meant was he would receive twice as much of his father's inheritance than any other child in the family. And personally, being the oldest son in my family, I think it's a great tradition we should bring back, right? I've actually proposed this to my mom and dad. I think they should write it in their will. My sister fought me on it. Anyway, it's all good, right? So anyway, so this is what's happening. So the younger son coming to the father, this makes sense. They know what Jesus is talking about. The younger son wants as much as the older son. He's upset. And so he's upset about things not being as fair as he wants them to be. And he says, "Dad, give me my inheritance now." The other thing that's most significant about that is basically the son is saying to the father, "You know what I wish, Dad? I wish you were dead." Which would be offensive in any society, today or then. But we know that as the story goes, as Jesus tells it, the father agrees and he gives the younger son his inheritance, and the younger son leaves and he goes off to a foreign land and he wastes it on women and parties and having a great time, eventually blows through his entire inheritance to the point he's working for a guy taking care of his pigs, which for a Jew there would be no bigger disgrace, and he's in the pig pen literally longing to eat what the pigs are eating. And then there's this brilliant phrase that Jesus uses. He says, "And when he came to his senses," when he came to his senses, he looks up and he says, "What am I doing? I mean, even my dad's servants have more to eat than I eat." And he thinks, maybe if I'll go back to my dad, if I'll humble myself, if I'll apologize, maybe he would hire me and I could serve him. At least then I'd have a place to stay and food to eat. And the story goes, as the son was approaching the father's house, the father, looking out, sees him coming, runs off the porch, grabs a hold of the younger son, puts his robe on him, puts his ring on his finger, tells his other servants, "Get the fatted calf, bring it, we're gonna have a party. This son of mine was dead and he's alive, he was lost, and now he's found." It's a beautiful story, right? That's the story of the prodigal. He was rebelling out of this desire for control, and he left and he ran away and he returns. It's a beautiful story. But there's another part of the story, and the other part of the story is the older brother, who during the party celebrating the younger brother's return, he's on the porch looking into the party, refusing to go in, and the father comes out and he says, "Son, come, enjoy, your brother's back." And you remember what the older brother does? He gets very upset with his dad. "How could you forgive him? How could you receive him? How could you accept him? You know what he did to you. You know what he said to you. You know how he offended you. He's blown through everything you gave him. He's wasted all of your inheritance while I have remained here. I've remained faithful. I've been your good son. I've done everything that's expected of a son to do for his father. And yet you're throwing him a party. You've never even given me a little goat to have with my friends." And the father says to the older son, "Son, everything I have is yours. Come in, come celebrate that your brother that was lost is now found." And as best we can tell, the older brother stood right there, arms folded, refusing to go in. Now, here's why I bring this story up today. Because at the centerpiece of the prodigal son, just like at the center of the story of Herod, is one issue. And the issue is all about control. See, for the younger son was trying to control fairness. "It's not fair to me, Dad, that my brother gets twice as much as I do. It's not fair that I'm going to have to wait. It's not fair. And so I demand you give me now what I deserve, what is due me." And in his attempt to control fairness, to be in control, do you know what the younger son did? He killed everything in his life that was good. First thing he kills is his family relationships. He's estranged from his father. He's estranged from his brother. He's isolated, alone, and at the lowest point in his life, he has no one around him to help pick him up except a herd of pigs. His desire for control killed the goodness of his family. Not only that, his desire to control killed his opportunities for his future. It killed his future. Can't you imagine being the dad going, son, you have, if you only could see what I see about what is possible moving forward, just be patient, wait. There are things coming that you cannot possibly understand. Be patient and wait. No, I want it and I want what I want now. Give me what I want and I'm going to go my merry way. And in so doing, he killed his future. And by killing his future and his desire to control fairness, you know what else he killed? He killed the joy of receiving his inheritance when he should have received it. You know, this is the interesting thing about an inheritance. On the one hand, it's a day of mourning because to receive an inheritance most likely meant that somebody died. But it's also a time of joy because you've been given something because you were their child or you were their family and they loved you and they're expressing their love to you by leaving something to you. And even though there should be a time of mourning through the death and loss of someone, there's also a sense of joy. Look at what was given to me. And I get to enjoy this from this day forward. But his desire to control fairness actually killed his opportunity to enjoy any of that because he was trying to control what is fair. Now, here's the thing. That's the younger brother. But you know what's also true? The older brother did the same exact thing. I mean, it wasn't about fairness. The younger brother's trying to control fairness. You know what the older brother's trying to control? Forgiveness. And in his attempt to control forgiveness, you know what he killed? The exact same things. He killed his family relationships. He killed the opportunity to restore friendship with his brother. He killed the opportunity to support his dad in a decision that even though he didn't agree with, dad, your son is back. Let me celebrate that with you. He killed his future because he could have a future working side by side with his brother in joy and celebration rather than resentment and begrudging what his father gave him. And I would argue too, he also killed his opportunity to enjoy the joy of his father's inheritance. Because you know what the father said to him? You remember? Son, everything I have is yours. And what did he say to his dad? I don't care. It's not fair for you to forgive him. You should not forgive. Now, here's what's so incredible to me about the story of the prodigal son. A couple things. First thing that's so amazing to me about the story is that every one of us in this room, ourselves in one way or another, is both of these brothers. We are both the prodigal and a Pharisee. We're both the one trying to control fairness and the one trying to control forgiveness. Each of us has tried to control God and control what God offers us or offers somebody else in that response. We've all been both the prodigal and the Pharisee because basically that's the Pharisee is the one that Jesus is basically saying the older son is. We've both been a prodigal. We've both been a Pharisee. But the other thing that's amazing to me is that the gospel of Jesus redefines what is fair about forgiveness by taking the control of forgiveness out of our hands and putting it into the hands of the Father, giving us not what we deserve, but what we need. And what's most incredible to me is that when we give up control by trusting God, we find the one thing that we most were longing for by trying to keep control. And you know what that is? Well, I'll read to you what it is. It's in Matthew chapter 2, verse 9. Look at what it says. This is about the wise men. After listening to the king, they went on their way, the wise men. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And when they saw it, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. What you and I are able to find by letting go of control and giving control over to God is we were able to find the one thing we were looking for all along, and that is true joy. The joy that only comes from surrendering to the Father. Herod was troubled, and he was furious, and his desire for control killed everything good around him. And then there's the wise men, and we're going to look more closely at them next week. But the wise men was not about control, it was about surrender. And here's what I think you learn from Herod and from the wise men. That when it came to those, Herod's need for control killed everything that was good around him, and the wise men found joy through their surrender. So in closing, I would define it this way for you. What is all of this about, and how is it that you and I relate so closely to the story of Herod, a guy that was crazy and paranoid and killed the ones he loved and tortured the ones he hated and all the things that he did that I've never done? How am I so closely related to Herod? By my need to be in control. And if you don't remember anything else today, I pray that you remember this, that keeping control, you know what it leads to? It leads to losing control. Keeping control leads to losing control, but surrendering control leads to great joy. If you're that person who just has to be in charge and in control, and you're trying to manage not only the details of your life, but even the other people around you in a way that they accomplish for you what you want to accomplish, if control is your struggle, the more you try and stay in control, the more you will lose control. And you realize both the younger and the older brother both lost control. The younger brother lost control of his morality. The older brother lost control of his mercy, of his grace, and of his rational thinking about his younger brother, all because they wanted to be in control. Keeping control leads to losing control. Surrendering control to Jesus Christ will lead you to great joy. And that's what we're going to talk more about next week. I want to ask you to bow your heads, and I want to pray for you this morning. Then we're going to close in a song that we're going to sing about this great joy that is ours in Jesus Christ. And Father, I thank you for this story and this message. And even though it's a character in the story that most of us would say, would struggle to think that we truly are like Herod, I think we all can recognize that we have a struggle, Lord, the struggle to be in control, to control the people around us, to control the circumstances around us. And sometimes, God, we even try to control you. And as your people, God, encourage us this morning with the story of Herod and the wise men, that we would not be ones seeking to control you, but we would surrender our lives to you. Because in that moment of surrender is the place we find our greatest joy in your Son, Jesus Christ. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen.